You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative minds behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Soprano Dina Kuznetsova and conductor Sir Andrew Davis are backstage at Lyric.
One of the unusual things about this opera, there are really no heroes and villains. Well, except Tatiana. I mean, she's probably a heroine, but in her own way. But they're all good people. And through the mischance, bad circumstances, pride, one thing, another thing, they're all unhappy. It's so Russian, you know.
One of the wonderful things about the piece is the way it switches from, for instance, the end of the first peasant dance into this wonderful intimate moment where we first see Tatiana's soul in one phrase, you know, in this very, very beautiful phrase that comes again and again in the piece. So there's a kind of quixotic quality to the way the music changes mood and scale. But it's so masterfully handled by Tchaikovsky, you never feel any kind of unnatural shift, you know.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of one of the world's great opera companies. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. For this episode, we're playing an audio transcript of the Lyric Opera Discovery Series session for Eugene Onegin. For those of you who may not be aware of the Discovery Series, it's panel discussions featuring singers, conductors, directors, and opera experts. We do one session per opera, and they usually take place a few days prior to the opening of the production. This session on Eugene Onegin is the final Discovery Series panel of the 2007-08 season. I'm your host for this session, and I hope you enjoy it. Andrew, when you began conducting Onegin, had you already performed these great showpieces, the waltz and the Polonaise, in concert?
No, because in fact, I conducted Onegin for the first time in 1975, so very early on in my career. I've done the Polonaise, especially. I don't do the waltz so much because.
Do you now include the waltz occasionally as part of a concert
program? Well, I've never done the waltz in concert. It's a marvelous piece, of course. I mean, I miss the voices, though.
I do too. Yeah.
And in fact, all the. I mean, there are four sort of ballet numbers in Onegin. There's the waltz, there's the mazurka, and then there's in the second scene, and then there's the Polonaise. Which, of course, is the beginning of the third act. And then there's this wonderful écossaise, or schottische, I suppose you would call it.
Right, at the end of the
Which are all quite remarkably brilliant showpieces for the orchestra.
Did conducting any other pieces of Tchaikovsky or studying them prepare you somehow to conduct Onegin?
Well, I think with any composer, the more of his works that you get to know and to work on and to interpret, they feed off each other. So, I mean, do I conduct Onegin better because I've conducted the Pathetique Symphony? Maybe. I hope so. I hope I conduct the Pathetique Symphony better because I conduct Onegin, you know. He was a remarkable composer. And one thing that we sort of forget was that he was very original in many ways, particularly harmonically. Some of the progressions, the harmonic progressions that you get in Tchaikovsky, even in pieces as familiar as the Romeo and Juliet overture, are quite startling, actually. It's just that we're used to them. You know, if hearing them for the first time, he goes off into very strange keys and then comes back in a very original way. I mean, it's easy to take Tchaikovsky for granted. You know, we will say, oh, well, you know, there's the Nutcracker and Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty, which are all works of total genius. I mean, people had written ballet scores, of course, before. Particularly a lot of French composers and other Russian composers, of course, too. But Tchaikovsky took the ballet to a completely unheard of and new level. And then, of course, Stravinsky followed him. I mean, it's this great Russian progression through there. But and of course, on all of the Russians of his time, Rimsky-Korsakov was also a great influence. And you see that in the way that, and also, that, don't you think, Dina, the kind of the French influence also in Russian culture,
which then
curiously enough went the other way. You know, there was all these long time when French was the language of the court in Russia, and French culture was highly revered. And then you know we suddenly get this thing with Diaghilev taking Russian culture to the Parisians. Of course, who took it to a very big way.
In fact, War and Peace starts in French. You know, you open the first page, and there's a whole page of a French dialogue, you know, because Tolstoy was writing about in 1812, you know, 1805 when it starts, I think it is, and all the nobility was speaking French, so you get pages and pages of French, and as a Russian, you know, you read this translation at the bottom, like, will I ever get through this? They're all speaking French, but then, of course, it becomes...
Yes, I guess they weren't teaching French as a second language in Russian schools recently.
There's also, Onegin, there's a whole little ariette that's sung in the first scene of Act Two by Monsieur Triquet, which is all in French, although there are a couple of recordings where it's sung in Russian.
Oh, it should be in French, because every good house had a French teacher, you know, and Triquet is kind of a representation of that. You know, there was a French tutor, and Onegin had a French tutor when he was young, and this is somebody who probably lives in the house and teaches French, and maybe dancing, something like that.
And also when Lenski comes on, I was just talking to our cover, Brian Griffin, today, who's singing, understanding the role of Lenski, and he says the very first line is like the hardest thing in the Russian text to sing in the entire role. But his very first word is not in Russian. He's addressing Madame Larina and her two daughters as Mesdames. So that's which I think is interesting too. But Andrew, was the complete opera Onegin something you had wanted to do? Or did it sort of come your way just by chance?
Well, I actually grew up all through my teens and my early years not really knowing much opera at all. I grew up in a small town, started to play the piano at an early age, became interested in orchestral music because the London Philharmonic Orchestra would come three times a year and play in our local town hall. So I used to go to all those concerts, but the Aidas, and actually I think I told you this before that when we did Aida, was it three seasons ago? Was it
three or four? Four or five. Yeah.
And Semyon Bishkov was supposed to conduct it, and as you recall, he actually fell down the stairs and hurt his shoulder. And this happened like 2 days before we were supposed to start rehearsals. So We didn't have very much choice. I decided I would do it myself. And I must say I enjoyed it very much, but somebody asked me at the time if I'd ever conducted Aida before, and I was able to say with complete veracity that I'd never even seen it. So this is, you know, I wasn't one of these people who grew up listening to Verdi and Puccini and indeed Wagner and Strauss and Mozart even at my mother's knee. And in fact, the first opera I went to see was a double bill of Stravinsky's Rossignol and Schoenberg Erwartung, I was about 15 and I suddenly got interested in 20th century music. So I used to find out all these peculiar things that were going. And so I didn't see my first Verdi opera until many years later. So in answer to your question, you know, when I first started conducting opera at Glyndebourne, where I, of course, subsequently became music director, but I suppose it was in the summer of 1972, Sir John Pritchard took me to lunch and said, we'd like you to come to Glyndebourne. He said, I'd like you to come be my assistant and take over some performances of Capriccio by Strauss, which I didn't know. I adore it. That's one of my five favorite operas, which always people always think is eccentric, but there we are. So that was my first opera, and then they said, would you like to conduct Eugene Onegin? So I said, yes, I would. And so I learned it. But no, I mean, I didn't know it until they'd asked me to do it. And it was a revelation, and it has remained so. I mean, I've done it, this is, I think, the fourth time I've conducted it in my career, and I love it more every time.
Dina, you're making your role debut as Tatiana. I've always assumed that Tatiana would just be the dream role for any Russian soprano, Do you agree with that? Is it something that you did dream about before it happened?
Yes, but also it relates to what I was telling before, that there is a lot of... It's not exactly a burden of responsibility, but, you know, but there's a whole kind of tale of great Russian sopranos, you know, of just sopranos doing this part, and a lot of kind of fixed ideas of how it's supposed to be sung or how it's supposed to be acted. So it is also challenging exactly in that way, you know, to open my mouth and not have all those, you know, five recordings which I listened to so many times scream in my ear, you know, do this or do this, you know, and just to do what comes naturally, you know, what we talked about is inherently in the music and not in the tradition, you know. So yes, it is a dream come true, and it also has its own challenges, you know. When I sing Italian or French repertoire, of course there is, you know, there is a whole line, even more so, a longer line of great traviatas. Nonetheless, they are not quite so much in my ear as Tatiana.
Now, in this music, there's no real opportunity for coloratura, and the highest climax doesn't come until the very end. So,
then it's very brief.
So what does this role really demand of you purely on the vocal side, and is it particularly different from any other major role that you've sung?
It is different. It lies much lower than what I usually sing. It's actually, sometimes, you know, I sang it with orchestra at rehearsals, and what it demands is a combination of really good legato and yet putting the kind of the detailed expression within that good legato. You know, and sometimes I sing some phrase and think, wow, that is so fun. Because it does require kind of this long, beautiful line. And then it's broken up by, you know, by her exclamations and impressions and expressions and all the detail one can put in the language, you know, consonants and how to phrase one thing or another thing. But I would say that the line is kind of the most... The thing without which the role does not exist. Yeah. I mean, Surrender, you have...
No, I was just going to say, of course, the thing about the role of Tatiana is that there's a big change between the first two acts and the third act, which is something that you have to encompass dramatically, and as a consequence vocally, I think, too, because in the first two acts, she's this young girl living in the country who's fallen madly in love with this man who rejects her. And then some years later, she has become a woman in much grander society who is the wife of a distinguished gentleman. And although her passions are still the same, the years have suppressed them in a way. And then, of course, they do come bursting out. But it's to make that change is an interesting dramatic necessity that I think you do quite wonderfully. And I have to say, you know, Dino's talking about a long line of great Tatianas. You're going to be the next one.
Thank you.
And it's I had the pleasure of doing the role only in concert, because she'd stopped singing on the stage at that point with the incomparable and beautiful Elisabeth Söderström, who was a great singer and great artist, great actress.
Great Russian, too.
Absolutely. Well, her father was Swedish, but her mother was Russian, so she spoke Russian, of course, fluently. As I say, we just did one concert performance in Toronto, my years with the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, and Nikolai Gedda sang Lenski. It was a it was a very beautiful occasion, and she made the role very much her own personally, in a way that you have too. I mean, you never the sense that one that I got from her and from you is that this is not, in any sense, a sort of vehicle for a wonderful soprano showing off her voice. You know, it's something where the vocalism has to grow out of the emotion and the drama.
Absolutely.
And at the same time, of course, you have to not let the emotion interfere with your vocal technique. I mean,
right.
That's a very sort of technical thing, but isn't that the right way of putting
Absolutely.
It in a way?
And I think I don't think it was ever meant to be as a purely vocal vehicle, because didn't Tchaikovsky write it for conservatory graduates, you know, to perform in Moscow Conservatory? So essentially by students, and it doesn't mean that it's easy, in fact, to get through the orchestra, you know, he quite gave a punch in terms
yes,
of orchestration.
Yes, there are some big moments, that's true.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that, you know, he obviously conceived it for students, and he didn't even call it an opera, he actually called it Lyric Scenes. So I don't know whether he had more modest ambitions for it when he was writing it than was in fact the case, because it is one of the great operas and the most touching operas, I think.
I mean, I always say that it absolutely requires lyric voices, juicy lyric, but lyric nonetheless. Andrew, I'm curious as to whether Ms. Söderström ever told you her whole thing about her progress with Tatiana. She said to me many years ago that it took her years before she could sing what she called a dry Tatiana, because she would always cry. And so it took for her forever to be able to control her emotions in the role. And I thought that was, it just showed me, you know, what the role can mean potentially to a soprano. And I mean, Dina, I had a hard time in the letter scene because I was just sitting there weeping, and I just thought, I wonder what you must be going through in the role playing it.
Well, letter scene is so hopeful. I actually, you know, I'm not really thinking about the future when I'm singing letter scene. I'm trying to only be hopeful as she is, you know, and thus it of course reflects the vocal coloring and lots of things. But totally off topic on Söderström, she's an exquisite woman with exquisite Russian, and I listened a lot in college to her complete recordings of Rachmaninoff songs, and it is just, I would recommend to anybody who loves Rachmaninoff.
What she said to me also was that she, on her tombstone, she sang all the songs of Rachmaninoff, even the ones that were written for Shalyapin.
Yes, she did. Yes.
But Dina, I wanted to come back to something related to the singing of this and the expression of this role. You are an outstanding recitalist, and you're used to singing with the kind of intimacy that recital repertoire demands. And when you come to hear Dina in this role, you will hear the most exquisitely subtle singing constantly in this, and I thought that comes from all the experience that she has had as a recitalist, I think. So aren't there an awful lot of opportunities in this opera where you're able to bring that kind of intimate expression into it, that it sort of calls out for that?
I hope so. You know, it's hard for me to before even the opening, it's hard for me to kind of analyze too much what I'm doing. But I hope so, and this role certainly gives one the opportunities, because I think Tchaikovsky wrote the lyrics, the words himself, didn't he?
Not everything, but
right,
a lot of it
verbatim, Pushkin,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But it's a beautiful libretto, and it really, there is nothing inane there, you know, in terms of language, you know, linguistics, how words are put together. So that kind of brings it closer to the recital repertoire, because one of the joys of recital repertoire is wonderful literature. You know, you're singing wonderful literature. So here it's certainly the case. And so I hope I can bring some of it there while keeping the, you know, grandeur of the opera, which it certainly has in huge amount.
Yes, and if I could go back to something that we were just talking about a little bit, which is the question of, you know, tears and emotions and Elizabeth sort of not being able to sing the role without crying. It poses this question of what the sort of balancing act that we all have to do as performers, because of clearly you have to be very... Like a great actor or actress, you have to be completely in the role. You have to, but also like a great actor or actress, I think one has to maintain a certain part of your brain or your soul or whatever it is, your mind, that actually enables you to negotiate the first of all the technical demands, but also. Lets you sort of watch yourself almost, and I think that's certainly as a conductor that's true, because I mean there have been times, in the dress rehearsal of the dialogues of the Carmelites last year, in the last that wonderful last scene when all the nuns are actually going to the guillotine, I was in floods of tears, but I wouldn't let myself do that anymore. I mean, I had to say, you know, you have to keep part of yourself, because then you lose your objectivity, and then the trombones play too loud and you don't notice. But you know what I mean? It's that kind of thing, and I think it's the same on stage too.
Very much so. Yeah. Because you always have to think what projects to the audience versus what you are feeling at the moment. And if you're not feeling anything, I don't feel good, because then I think I'm lying or faking. But yet, if I feel too much, then I might feel great, but everybody else is not going to get the same emotion, because it's going to be kind of like all within me. So it's balancing.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
I want to go back to the letter scene, because the letter scene is really the emotional heart of the whole piece. I mean, Dina, what you had talked about being hopeful in that scene, what are the other important qualities that you need to communicate to the audience in the course of the sort of dramatic arc of that scene?
It's an abandonment of a shy person. You know, Tatiana is a shy introvert. So it is the feeling of kind of stepping over the cliff, but it wavers between kind of joy of that and fear. I don't know. Does that answer your question? It's complicated, because on the one hand she is a very young girl. On the other hand, we had actually some discussions. I personally think she's 18. Some people think she's earlier. Younger. I think she's 18. August 16. But it is. The youthfulness and kind of joy of an emotionally sophisticated person. You know, that way maybe she's slightly different from the, you know, some heroines like Gilda, for example, who is, all kind of purity and hopefulness, but of a girl. You know, Tatiana is smart and well-read and she feels very much alone and out of place. So it's...
Because she's looking for a soulmate.
She's looking for a soulmate, yes.
Now, I wanted also to talk about the scene that follows, where she meets Onegin and he rejects her. And the standard view of Onegin in this scene has always been that he's cold and he's callous and he's nasty. And when you listen to the music that he sings, it really is not that. And so I've started to think of him solely in terms of he's being firm, but he's being polite, and he is being honest. So do you view him that way in that scene?
I personally do, yes.
So does that mean...
Not Tatiana, but I do. Yeah,
but does that mean that her response to him later on, when she talks about what it was like to be rejected by him, is actually unjustified because he wasn't really being as cruel as all that?
No, because she acknowledges that he, in the circumstances and within his feelings, he was right. I mean, she says verbatim, you were right back then. If you did not like me, you did what you had to do. Her response is kind of tough to him or cruel to him only if we take the circumstances into the consideration that now he is madly in love with her and she is still in love with him. You know, so, but maybe actually because she's in love with him, her only way of not giving in is to be rather hard on him. But they're very much, you know, cultured, polite people. Just like he was proper, she's trying to be proper. Another thing that it does not work out at the end, quite proper, you know, and that's one of the joys of, you know, poem and opera. But she's doing her best to be objective and to just simply tell him off.
Andrew was talking before about this transition that you have to make from the young girl to the princess. And there was a moment in the dress rehearsal where I thought, oh, that is just so right. It's a very small moment, but I think you took your shawl and you just put it on the chair in front of you with this gesture that was very much a regal woman's gesture and not that of a young girl. And it had such dignity. And I thought, you just see physically in that moment, you see the transition. So are there other things that you do in that scene to establish the fact that she is a different person from what we saw in the first day?
Well, I'm giving up a secret.
Yeah, well, that's right. We can't give too much away here.
The whole once the time passes, I hope I remember that for the opening and later. I constantly tell myself, keep your back straight, keep your neck up, you know, keep your head up, because they had a very different training back then, you know, in terms of deportment. Yeah. And what is allowed to a little country girl would not be allowed to a big, grand society woman. So you have to, with kind of your whole body, carry yourself like you've been trained to be a society woman. And it has its challenges, but I'm trying.
Andrew, I think it's so interesting in this piece that the contrasts are so extreme between the grandeur of the party scene and the ball scene and the incredible intimacy that is so much a part of other scenes. So I want to talk about both of those. I mean, I think the central melodies in this piece are pretty straightforward, but we all recognize, I think, when we hear them phrased in a manner that sounds authentic to our ear. So when you're working with players and with singers who, unlike Dina, have not grown up with the traditions of this music, how do you help them to achieve what we would call a real Tchaikovsky style as opposed to another late Romantic style, whether it's Verdi or Wagner?
Well, it's an interesting question because as a conductor, I like to achieve most of what I do with orchestras by saying as little as possible. So in a way, this is something that's slightly mysterious even to me, how the string sound that you want to hear in Tchaikovsky, you're quite right, is very different from what you want to hear in Strauss or Mozart. And now, I mean, you have a very intelligent orchestra that is used to playing in many different styles. But I would say Russian music is probably, I mean, over the years, this orchestra has played some Prokofiev, and, you know, we did Queen of Spades. I don't think we've ever done any Rimsky-Korsakov. I'm not sure we have.
No.
No. I mean, but there's a whole Russian repertoire, but...
We did Borodin. We did Prince Igor at one point.
Ah, yes. Boris, yes.
And Kovanchina and Boris, of course.
Yeah. Boris also based on Pushkin, right? Boris Godunov, yeah.
Yes.
But there's a kind of intensity in that you have to have in the sound, and at times a rather febrile quality, you might almost say. So it's a different kind of intensity of timbre and of a kind of emotional overtones that I didn't particularly have to talk about. I mean, I did say in one rehearsal, I think, stop playing Brahms, but and the my relationship with the orchestra is has become over the years so close that I don't need to say a lot of things because they know the sort of things that I look for. But so it's actually hard for me to answer your question. It's this sort of mysterious thing that a conductor has a sound in his head that he wants to hear, and if he's good, he can somehow make the orchestra reproduce it. And I can't really analyze how I or anybody else does it. And sometimes you have to talk about it. Sometimes you have to say no, that's not right because you know there's too much pressure with the bow and after all orchestral and opera orchestra players know a lot of Tchaikovsky's symphonic and balletic repertoire as well. So it's not as though they're unfamiliar with style. But it's important always to find that essence of the orchestral sound that gives the piece its authenticity and its flavor and its color and its emotional subtlety. So that's what I try to do, but...
In all of these arias, it seems to me that you as a conductor have to be totally almost breathing with the singer, but you've also got these tricky scenes involving the chorus in Act 1 and 2. What are the greatest challenges for you there?
Well, they are tricky, I have to say, starting particularly, I mean, the very first chorus entry is the peasants who are coming in from the fields after a day of harvesting. And there's this wonderful... a cappella section when they're off stage, which has, you know, it reminds you of all those wonderful Russian liturgical things. You know, it has that texture of it, which is another great Russian tradition, culminating, I think, in the Rachmaninoff Vespers, which is one of the most extraordinary choral pieces. And then there's a very rambunctious kind of peasant dance, and they are doing a lot of dancing. And that's always a problem. it's like patting your head and rubbing your stomach. You know, it's and we have of course a wonderful chorus who are very experienced at this, but there are a lot of difficulties with the which I think we have successfully surmounted. I'm happy to say. Similarly, of course, in the waltz they're dancing, but they don't dance the Polonaise, neither, indeed, nobody dances the Polonaise. In fact, since we do Acts 2 and 3 continuously, the Polonaise, certainly the beginning of it, is used in a rather unusual way, which I shall not tell you about. however, it is rather a curious visual counterpart to the festiveness of the Polonaise itself. That's all I'm going to tell you. The chorus is a very vital part of this opera, especially at the beginning, in the first two acts. What were we talking about? My mind is completely off and on.
What makes those scenes tricky?
What makes those scenes tricky? Well, that's one thing. I mean, the chorus having to do all kinds of running around the stage as well as singing in a very cohesive way. But you're right. One of the wonderful things about the piece is the way it switches from, for instance, the end of the first peasant dance into this wonderful intimate moment where we first see Tatiana's soul in one phrase, you know, in this very, very beautiful phrase that comes again and again in the piece. So there's a kind of quixotic quality to the way the music changes mood and scale. But it's so masterfully handled by Tchaikovsky. You never feel any kind of shift, unnatural shift, you know.
Dina, I did want to go back to the Pushkin for a minute because I wanted to ask you whether there were any descriptions or events or even characters in the Pushkin novel that are eliminated in the opera that you actually think might have been sort of helpful.
I don't know what might have been sort of helpful. The novel itself, I actually have to say, I reread it, you know, shortly before coming here again and to rehearse, and I was stunned at how much I liked it. But no, because you know you have some memories through the years. But it's very rich. What I guess the biggest elimination from the novel to opera is Pushkin himself, because not in a bad way. I mean, Pushkin as a character, not as a spirit of Pushkin. You know, spirit of Pushkin is beautifully transferred to the opera. In the novel, there is a lot of personal reflection. There is a lot of moments of biography. And in fact, Onegin himself is presented as one of Pushkin's friends. And that tells us a lot about how Pushkin saw Onegin, because Pushkin was one of those kind of brilliant people and members of the high society who had extremely interesting and creative friends in all spheres. You know, some were scientists, some were running the most prestigious colleges, some were military, but part of his closest friends became actually revolutionaries, and not revolutionaries in the Soviet sense, but although it eventually led to the revolution in the Soviet sense, but they were kind of those members of nobility who wanted a constitutional monarchy or a democracy at the time when there was nothing like that could even be thought about in Russia, and there was this event in 1825 when the members of nobility, actually without really much hope of overcoming the monarchy, they went, the best men of the best families, they went to this square before the coronation to demand constitutional monarchy. As a result, they were all sent to Siberia, five were hung, and the rest were sent to Siberia. And a lot of them were Pushkin's friends. In fact, he himself had to go into exile for a while, although not to Siberia, because he was not directly connected to that. But he was very brave in the situation, and he was writing this beautiful poetry supporting his friends, which then the wives of those friends were taking to Siberia to them. It's one of those kind of touching and beautiful moments of Russian history, which Pushkin is a part of. And so when Pushkin calls Onegin his friend, you kind of understand the intellectual and also emotional stature of that person, because just somebody, you know, flip-flop, kind of the fop, the word, what, fop, yeah. Kind of the useless fop would not be a friend of Pushkin. So so there is a lot of that kind of detail in the poem, but in terms of the spirit of the story, I think it's beautifully transferred into the opera. Of course, inevitably, all the reflection on life is cut out.
Now, one thing that we do need to talk about before I open the floor to a question or two is the production that we're doing, which we haven't said much about. Right. So, Andrew, what do you think this Metropolitan Opera production's great strengths are that the audience can look forward to?
It's very striking visually. It's a Robert Carson production and has all his hallmarks of being very spare, a sort of large space in which the focus is very strongly on the people. But it has, from the very beginning, it has this wonderful autumnal feel about it, which completely sums up the kind of mood, the tone, the style of the piece, I think. And so immediately you're put into this world. The colours are very autumnal, and the leaves on the stage. And you know, like a lot of his best work, it's so many things are achieved with great simplicity, but they're very striking. And as I say, the focus is entirely on the people. So you know, in the very last scene, we see Dina alone with one chair in the middle of the stage, and immediately everything is distilled to this one person and what she is and will be feeling, somebody who we've already grown to love, who is now in a different place. And alone. I mean, the symbolism of that solitariness is again captures the essence of where she is as a person. I think, happily married to a very distinguished gentleman, but still a marriage of convenience or
still without
of
a soulmate.
Yes. I mean, he's very simple. I think Gremin is a very sympathetic character. I mean, we don't get much from him, except that he sings a very beautiful aria in which he sings about his genuine love for his wife. And one of the most popular bass arias in the repertoire, I would say, and very beautiful.
The production is also, though, something of a memory play, isn't it? I mean, that we start with Onegin on stage alone, and clearly
start with him alone on the stage, and then when it fades, which makes the Tatiana's appearance at the beginning of the third act in the same kind of pose rather striking, and draws nicely the fact of the reversal of roles that goes on in the piece.
And part of the Gremin being, you know, also a nice person, that one of the unusual things about this opera, there are really no heroes and villains. Well, except Tatiana. I mean, she's probably a heroine, but in her own way. But there are really no bad people, you know, no bad people. They're all good people. And through the mischance, bad circumstances, pride, one thing, another thing, they are all unhappy. It's so Russian, you know.
Well, they do that better than anybody.
Think,
we know that.
Do you think one reason why it's not done as much as those other operas I was mentioning before is because we don't end with Tatiana on the stage, whom we love. We end with Onegin. He's the last person we see on the stage. Do you think audiences are just sort of disappointed that it's not Tatiana who we see
at the
end?
Well, the opera is, after all, called Onegin.
Indeed. But he's also he's not really judged,
probably incorrectly.
No, so is the poem, you know. It is, despite the fact that Pushkin many times says in the poem how much he loves Tatiana as a character, it is Onegin, yes.
Yes, but that's the point. That it's so ultimately what we're left is his despair. And it's very abrupt, of course. The ending itself is, we have this wonderful scene, very passionate and extraordinarily animated scene between the two of them, when he's really quite violently, sort of like a teenager almost, pressing his love upon her. And she, of course, still loves him, so she's drawn to that, but another part of her has to make the decision that she has to reject him, with no sense of getting her own back. I don't think there's never any sense that's her motives, because she'd like nothing better to run off with him. And this is something we always have to remember and sometimes I think the age that we live in kind of has taken some of the edge and the pathos off these situations. And you look, I mean, I was just reading, I just read three Thomas Hardy novels. And you look at these people and you think, why are you behaving so stupidly? Or why are you denying yourself this, you know, this something that you ought to be, the expression of yourself that you ought to be giving you? And the answer is because that was the framework of society in which people lived for centuries in a way that 21st century human beings find it hard, itinerated in the Western world, find it hard to relate to. And I suppose, you know, some of the Oriental and the Arab cultures still maintain the sort of rigidity, socially speaking, that used to be also the norm in Europe for a long time. So, you know, it's that fight against convention and what's expected, not only just what's expected from the outside, but what you actually believe yourself. I mean, that's why Tatiana doesn't run off with him, because all her training, all the social environment when she lived taught her that one didn't do that.
Well, that, yes, but also the person that she is, I think part of it is that she does know how much Grimmin loves her,
yes,
and she cannot bear to break his heart too. You know,
that's right. Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
It's part of it is societal, but part of it is simply, you know, trying to be the best person you can.
Yes, yes, I agree. But I mean, that's, you have the same thing. I mean, Thomas Hardy, you have the same thing in Jude the Obscure,
definitely,
which is a novel I just read. Which is, and they all behave idiotically, but it's also, but it's partly not wanting to hurt the other person and to do the right thing, but always somehow ending up doing it wrong. You know, and that's just kind of irony that's present in Onegin too.
We're rapidly running out of time, but is there a question or two from any of you back there? And could you speak loudly, please? Mahler thought that Queen of Spades was a significantly better opera than Onegin.
Well, what did he know? He wrote symphonies. No. I mean, that is an interesting question, and in a way, Queen of Spades is a more operatic opera than Onegin is. You know, that really is an opera. This is lyric scenes, so that could be, you know, and Mahler had a taste for the grand, so that could be the reason.
Back there, yes, ma'am. Yes?
Actually, yes. Yes, they are coming. My mom is flying from Moscow. I mean, she's not only coming to hear Eugene Onegin, she's also coming to be with her three-year-old for a while and to see me. But she's coming to Chicago right after the opening, and she'll see it hopefully more than once. And I'm looking forward to that. My family is coming too, with a family who is in Boston and the United States, yes. In terms of singing it, in Russia or somewhere, I'm very happy to be singing it here, and I'm very grateful to the lyric that I was given the chance, and I'm just happy to be singing it right now. So ask me in 10 years.
Yes. On that note, I think Jesse, do we have time for one more question? If it's a short one, is there any correlation between the heroines of Queen of Spades and Eugene Onegin, and also between Onegin and the Pathetique Symphony?
Well, they're both late works, relatively speaking. The Pathetique Symphony is extraordinary because it really takes us into a realm of kind of despair and unreality that's unique in Tchaikovsky, and I think it's, for me, it's probably his greatest masterpiece. But I love doing it. Yes, they one can see the similarities. Lisa in The Queen of Spades and Tatiana are, yes, I mean they both I suppose suffer similar rejection.
But different fates.
Lisa throws herself into the river, and Tatiana's alive at the end.
There, of course, there's more similarity between Lisa and Katya Kavanova, which is also based on a Russian.
Right. Yes, sure is.
I don't think we have any more time, so I want to encourage all of you to come to Onegin, not just once, but more than once, because it's going to be...
Actually, let me just say, because one of the things that Aria David just said was that, just for how wonderful it is to have four Russian singers in the cast, and I think that's absolutely right. And I think, listen, I mean, Dina sings in French and Italian and all sorts of other languages, but actually the feeling that one I get from you singing in Russian is that it's something that's so special and that you can bring something to it that I can't imagine anyone who hasn't the background and the soul and all the experience of what being Russian means, quite apart from the linguistic qualities, of course. So we are indeed fortunate, I think, to have four wonderful Russian artists or Russian-speaking artists. One of them is Georgian.
Russian-speaking, exactly. Yes.
One of them is Georgian. We don't count them.
So thank you so much, Sir Andrew Davis and Dina Kuznetsova.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features interviews with the creative forces behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.